Welcome to Next Us 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I'm your host, Dr. JC. The inaugural season of Next Us 818 Podcast focuses on the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion, the only all African American, all female battalion to serve in the European Theater of Operations during World War II. If you're tuning into the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out the inaugural episode from September the 7th of 2022 to learn about the background of the 6888 Battalion. In most episodes, I have interviewed 6888 descendants. In episode 14, we will talk with the author of a historical fiction novel about the 6888 Battalion. My guest tonight is Kaia Alderson, author of the novel Sisters in Arms, a novel of the daring Black women who served during World War II. Welcome, Kaia.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So I'd like to start with a few interesting facts.
All right, let's go.
All right. If I'm correct, Sisters in Arms is the first historical fiction novel about the 6888 Battalion.
That I wrote, yes.
I looked around. I didn't see any others.
There is another one. There's Mare's War by Tabitha S. Oh, my God. I just blanked on her last name.
And second, your novel has been described as a gripping portrayal of what it means to be a Black woman in the 1940s and what it takes to overcome obstacles in the pursuit of respect, recognition, and independence. That's a very nice description.
Yes, I like that. Yeah, sure.
Personally, I found it to be compelling. I had trouble putting it down. So I had to, I have the
sorry, not sorry.
I had the paperback version and I have the Audible version. So now let's talk about the development of the novel, Sisters in Arms. Mm-hmm. Understand that your specific areas of interest are women's military history, mm-hmm. popular music, women in mm-hmm. sports, upper-class African-Americans, and women's international travel.
Yes.
So give us a quick synopsis of the book Sisters in Arms.
Sisters in Arms is basically the story about two Black women in the 1940s who have to figure out what to do with their lives once their perfectly laid plans just go to everything. And so they basically have to do like a record scratch, and they find themselves in the Women's Army Corps that had just formed in 1942. So we have Eliza, who is coming from an upper middle class background in Harlem, the pampered princess of her family. And then we have Grace Steele, who isn't as well off, but she is an aspiring concert pianist who's very rigid and has her very peculiarities and almost has the not like the girls other mentality about herself.
Okay. I found them very fascinating characters, and I could see, you can see people you know in them, mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. though that was the 40s. Mm-hmm. So where did the idea come from for centering your novel around the 6888 Battalion?
It all started with a picture I saw on Twitter of the real-life 6888 marching in Rouen, France, when they were commemorating Joan of Arc and marching through the square where she was actually burned at the stake. And at that point, I had never seen anything like that. I knew my World War II history. I knew about the Women's Army Corps. I knew about the Black male soldiers. So intellectually, it wasn't necessarily a surprise that there were Black women serving in the WAC. I just never seen it or seen any reference to it. So to see that particular picture was like, whoa. Because I looked at it and I said, that looks like the 40s. That looks like Europe. And I know right. those are Black women. What is that? So once I looked that up and I saw, oh, wait, we were over there. I was like, oh, my God, I have to write a story about soldier girls last night in town versus all of the World War II soldier boys last night in town stories that we've seen, you know, over the past years.
So what makes this story so compelling? The 6888 story so compelling?
To me, just the fact that they were there, the picture, the image of what Black women or the opportunities they had in the 1940s from popular culture and literature, movies and TV, I didn't get that, you know, that we were doing things like that. And, excuse me, you know, I was the kid that my dad gave me when Harlem was in vogue, the book about what life was like for Black people in Harlem in the 20s. And even then, when I got that book, I was like, Black people were doing that? Because on the cover is a woman in a full-length mink in front of a Rolls Royce in the middle of Harlem. And you know, again, that's not the picture that we tend to get of Harlem in any date or time, except for recently. And then it isn't necessarily centered on Black people. So, you know, my image of what Black women were able to do, even despite my family background, is like, oh, we were mostly maids, sharecroppers, you know, everybody was, you know, shuffling along, heads down, because, you know, the oppression was so bad that you just couldn't get ahead. And it's like, no, in the 6888, it was a self-contained unit. You had Black female officers, which meant that if they didn't have a college degree, they at least had a little bit of college education. And that's even during a point in time when only 4% of the US population had a degree, you know, regardless if you were Black, white or Black or anything in between. And so, you know, the fact that, you know, women who probably this was their first opportunities to go overseas, their first introduction to something as rigid as military life, I was just like fascinated by it.
So why do you think it was so important to tell the story? And well, related to that, why did you
Okay.
choose fiction as your genre for the portrayal?
There's actually a lot of nonfiction information about the 6888 out there by professional historians, as well as the women themselves who served and had that experience. And I wanted to play around with certain themes and ideas that didn't necessarily fit any one person's story. Plus, you know, that person may still be alive. The real life person may still be alive, or their family members. They can always tell that story. But I wanted to talk about the limited opportunities for women, or the fact that it wasn't not everybody. You know, there were very proud women, educated or otherwise, who were doing interesting things. And I wanted to talk about that and highlight it. And the fact is, I wrote the book, or this fiction book was needed because I want to help change that picture of the popular imagining of what Black people, especially Black women, could do back then. I'm finding the more I read, the more I'm like, what we've been told or what we've been sold is act yes, that happened to some people, but that wasn't the whole picture.
Right. Well, it's so interesting. I've in the process of going through my mother's items from 6888, I also ran into a lot some boxes. And we moved up from my parents' house from my father, and you start to go through and find found my granduncle's 1919 Howard University senior yearbook. And so we're talking about 1900s, and then we were doing some historical research on the family down in Georgia over the holidays, and discovered that my paternal grandfather was one of only eight Black men in Savannah who was registered to vote. So there are fascinating things that people really don't think about and don't know about, and there's so much to explore. How long did it take you to research and write the novel?
I first saw that picture maybe 10 years ago, and I finally finished the book, turned in the final draft and edits a week after January 6th, because that week was interesting. Like, am I really expected to finish this book with everything else going on?
It
And
certainly gave you something positive to focus on.
But in terms of the process, it didn't necessarily, I thought the research would be harder than it was. Again, when I first saw that picture, I was like, okay, Google, let's see what you do. Black women, World War II. And the first thing that pops up is the 6888. And I was like, oh, okay, they're not an unknown thing. They're just not popularly known.
Right. Well, that's certainly getting ready to change. I think with the
Oh, yeah.
With the Tyler Perry's 6888 Netflix film and the characters he selected, I think it's going to make get the word out to a lot of people who did not know about these hidden figures.
Yes. And there's actually another novel that's getting ready to come out. The author's name escapes me, but it's Women of the Post. And
Okay.
then there's also previous to my novel was the Mare's War by Tanita S. Davis, which is actually a young adult novel told from the grandmother's perspective. as a teenager in the or as a young woman in the 1940s who was a part of the 6AAA, and then in contemporary times through the eyes of her granddaughter going on a road trip with her grandmother and realizing her grandmother actually did some really cool things back in the day.
Right. It's funny you should say that because when I my daughter, she spent a lot of time with her grandparents, and so she says, "Wow, I only knew grandma as this old person who's trying to tell me what to do and not trying to make me perfect." She said, "I never knew the grandma had all these adventures, and
I had an actual life.
what well, she knew she had traveled, but she never, you don't think of them as being young and adventurous when you're living with them." And so you get to kind of this whole process of doing these podcasts and meeting families has actually been a great source of insight, I think, for me and for my family as well. So just it's great. So Sisters in Arms is fascinating, and Grace Steele and Eliza Jones are very compelling characters. Tell me about your character selection and the character development process.
Well, when I first started working on the book, was basically Grace. It was if you haven't re if you read the book, it was actually focused more on Grace and Jonathan, and basically she meets the perfect guy on the night that she's leaving town to go to war. And so I was started thinking
And
about that, and
he's also in the
then
military, which complicates things.
yeah, his role within the War Department is like, oh, and because you are a black woman in the WAC, and there's so many, all eyes are on us, so you really can't break the rules or slide the rules or anything like that. He's like, no, I can't mess with you right now. But while I was thinking about who is this woman, what was her, we know that she's about to have this great adventure, but who was she up to this, what, how did she become who she was up to this point? And that's when I remembered this homework assignment I had in middle school where we were supposed to talk to the oldest person in our family about what they did during the war. And I thought about my Aunt Carmen. And basically, she was a character. When I knew her later in life at her funeral, at her very proper Episcopalian funeral, the opening procession was "I Did It My Way" by Frank Sinatra,
Sinatra, yes.
and no one batted an eye. I was like, yep, that's exactly right. So,
She
in my head,
sounds like my father. That was his one of his lines. It's
on her deathbed, she was telling folks, you know what, I'm mad at you, I've been mad at you, and I'm gonna be mad at you forever, because of something you did 30 years ago. And they had no idea, so she was a real character. But when I talked to her about this assignment, I was completely surprised when she said that she was a civilian filing clerk for the army during the war. Because all I had known of her was that she had been a school teacher in Harlem, and she'd been a school librarian and things like that. And I was just like, I was not expecting that at all. And I was like, my first thing was like, they let black people do that back then? And then she said, she laughed, because she said the only reason why she got that job was her supervisor was amused by the fact that he had this colored girl with a college degree. And as I did more researching about who the real life women were and what was going on, I realized there's a whole bunch of black women within the 6AAA who had a bunch of colored girls with college degrees. And I was like, oh, well, guess what, world? We about to learn about these colored girls with college degrees. So that kind of fed into it. And just Grace is not my Aunt Carmen, but there's certain factors of her personality. Just how did she start? What are the things that happened to her as a young woman that made her into the woman that I knew later on? And also, I would remember at Thanksgiving, not Aunt Carmen specifically, but her aunt, my Aunt Florence, would she was born in 1900, and at Thanksgiving, her and her friend would always be at the table at the end, just giggling amongst themselves. They interacted with everybody, but it's like, what are they talking about? And it's like, how did that lifelong friendship start? And it made me think about, okay, within the army, within this experience, we always hear about army buddies going on and on for deck. Well, what does that look like for black women, and what happened to, what was that, inciting moment for these friendships that would last a lifetime? Oh, and what if they hated each other on sight? So it was things like that. And then I initially wrote, was working on the book to be a romance, so it centered Jonathan and Grace. But when the book deal with William Morrow came up, and they said they saw it more as a women's fiction title, so it was more woman centered, I realized I needed another character to play off, and that's where Eliza came from. And I was like, okay, so what's her deal?
And she's
And
quite a
that's,
character.
yeah, she is. I remembered the movie from the early 80s, Private Benjamin, which is about a rich or a wealthy Jewish woman who found herself enlisting in the army unexpectedly. And I was just like, huh, well, what if I put a rich black girl in the army in the 1940s? What does that look like? And then I added the extra layer of, what if she looks so young that no one took her seriously? And that was from my own personal experience, because when I graduated from college, I looked about 12. And it took a while for people, the adults around me to,
Recognize that you were a real
yeah,
adult.
to, yeah, to not treat me, or their initial interaction with me is they think they're dealing with a 12-year-old. I'm like, I'm 23 years old. And okay, that's cute. You know, you answered it, is your mom, your daddy home? I'm the homeowner or leaseholder. Like, what do you want? Type of thing. So I just said, okay, that'll be interesting. Let's go with that. And so that's how I got to Grace and Eliza.
Okay. So if you could, if they, think about it, if there were going to be a movie and you could pick actors for your characters, who would you pick for your three main characters?
For Grace, it would be Kiki Palmer. For Eliza, it would be Kyla Pratt. And then for Jonathan, I have so many. I've never been able to pinpoint. I could see John Boyega. I could see Aldis Hodge. I could see a young Blair Underwood. For Eliza's father, I could also see an older Blair Underwood, or I could see a Keith David.
Okay. Makes sense. So who's your literary role model? Or do you have one?
Alice Walker and Zora Neale Hurston, and then Beverly Jenkins.
Okay. So what was the important lesson you learned while writing this novel? And or important lessons. I mean, it might be about the 6888, it might be about writing. That's an open question.
Never give up. The longest thing I'd ever written prior to this project was maybe 28,000 words, or about 100 pages. And Sisters in Arms was 104,000 words, or about 400 pages when I finished. And I had to figure out how to write a novel, because the only way I can explain it is if you run track, there's a different strategy or approach you have between running a sprint, middle distance, or long distance. And
Right.
I was bare, I was like still, finding my way through the middle distances, and now I'm running a marathon. I'm like, okay. I would also say, I learned the big things that the big, incredible, impressive things that people do, including me writing this novel, is everything happens in little baby steps. And in my case, the only way I could get this book done with a full-time job, with a, what was it? I think she was just a year when I got the book deal, and I had an aging mom in failing health. I only got this book done writing in 10-minute spurts, 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there. And it wasn't like, oh, you will waste a lot of time waiting for that perfect bubble of 4 hours where you might get 2 heavy hours of writing done. It was just wasn't going to happen. So even with non-writing stuff, if I have a big project, I break it down. Okay, what can I get done in 10 minutes?
Okay. That'll work. That's one certainly one approach. Because you're right, time is finding enough time to sit down and focus is always a challenge, and particularly when you have a in the situation you described, which is a typical American situation, you've got multiple generations to work with. So
Yes,
we're
ma'am.
blessed to have multiple generations to work with. So now I want to segue and talk about you and your educational background and career. You are a native of Piscataway, New Jersey,
Yes, ma'am.
and a proud Spelman College graduate.
Yes, ma'am.
And so Sisters in Arms is your first novel, and a highly successful one at that. So tell me about your educational background and career.
Who I attended Spelman College in the mid-90s. I was a sociology major with a minor in writing. I actually started off as an econ major, but after that semester with my econ book is my boyfriend, and I'm very proud of that low B I think I got. I think I got a B. I was like, I can't do this. I'm not that interested. And so I switched to sociology when everyone's like, what are you going to do with that? And I'm like, I don't know. And I was able to, when I finally could hold up the book to my dad, see, Dad, I'm using my degree. And most people even thought, like, why are you a sociology major? You should be an English major. And I'm like, I don't want to read. I didn't want to do the British lit, actually. I struggled with British lit in high school, and I just can't read it, in depth like that again. And sociology was actually way more interesting to me because it's the study of people and how people interact. So it's basically with character development and creating these scenes and these interesting things. Just to build the scenes, I'm like, okay, what's really going on here in the background? What type of group dynamics are we have going on? Or even with just developing our characters, there's a thing in sociology called social history, where you piece together a person's life story based on the events that they lived through. So with Eliza and Grace, I knew that they were born in 1916 and 1919. So what did they see while growing up? They experienced, at least in Grace's living memory, in my head, she was born in Charleston, and her family moved from Charleston to New York as a result of the 1919 Charleston riot, racial riot. At 3 years old, that she could have remembered that, or seen some of that, or the terror associated with that, and just okay, so that fit into her personality. You have what's her name? Eliza, who was born in 1919. She grew up in the 20s with these parents who had a lot of money. And then she also survived through the 30s. They grew up in Harlem in the 30s. So they would have seen some of the Harlem Renaissance, things like that. And then even with Eliza's mother, in terms of her background, what if she had ambitions and she wanted to do things, but as a young woman in the 20s, she had even less opportunities. So that's how the sociology played in, and love of history. You could say sociology, history, and a little bit of psychology mixed together. But that's kind
We
of
have
what,
some common interests, an undergraduate sociology major, minor in history. So,
things like that. So, that's how it played in. That all kind of played together. I also have a master's degree from University of West Georgia. What is it? A master's of education with the specialization in media and instructional technology. So my day job is I'm a curriculum designer. I design online training. But for that, there's a storytelling element in that, and being able to use technology, which helped me do my research, how to, put things together that may seem boring on the surface in an interesting and engaging way. So it all kind of play. I'm using all of my degrees.
well, that's wonderful to be able to do that. So, what motivates you as a writer?
What motive? The Toni Morrison quote, if you do not see the book that you want to read, you must write it. I was the kid, it drove my parents crazy. The greatest thing ever invented in my eyes as a kid was the bookstore. It was Walden, when Walden Books and Barnes and Noble came to town. And I would just walk around for hours, even in a Walden bookstore in the mall, which isn't as big as Barnes and Noble, trying to find the book I wanted to read, because it's like, no, that one isn't what I want it to be about. And I just couldn't figure it out. And when I saw that quote, I was like, I guess I could try writing. So I would say that. And just finding these fascinating stories where we may have just bare bones information about people. We don't have enough necessarily for the requirements of a nonfiction book, but with fiction, and again, reconstructing social histories, you can come up with some really, really fun stories.
So that's a good segue to my next question. Historical fiction is a special genre. What exactly is it, and how does it differ from fiction?
Basically, it is fictional stories inspired by real life people or real life events. And again, like I said, you're able to kind of figure out people's stories, even though you don't have enough to say to fill a 300 page history textbook or nonfiction book, but you're able to come up with things, at least in my case with my book, things that were plausible. Obviously, my characters are not real and these things did not happen to them, but I'll say 90, at least 90% of everything that happened that they experienced, somebody in real life experienced. So it's just, for me, it's more fun. I get to play around a little bit. I don't know if I'd ever find that perfect historical figure to talk about, to say introduce that. Yes, we had black female concert pianists in the 30s and 40s. The first black female applicant to the school that we now know as Juilliard, the earliest I could find was like in 1923, 24. Again,
Okay.
and that's all. I just know her name and I know that fact. So I'm not able to tell her story necessarily at this point, but I was able to, kind of say, if someone says, well, that never happened, black women weren't going to Juilliard at the time. Yes, they were. Hazel Scott was offered a scholarship to Juilliard at the age of 8 in the 30s. So things like that. So I'm able to play around with different things in different ways and put people in such, real life situations, but there's a whole something completely different on going on in the background to help give that story color and more action and conflict.
Okay. So you already answered my next question. I was going to ask you
Okay.
what inspired you to enter the world of historical fiction, but your quote from Toni Morrison gives context to that.
Yeah, I love historical fiction. I read widely different eras and things, but it's only until recently I'm seeing a me or us and or telling our stories and what we experience. And again, I'm not knocking necessarily the experiences of someone who was a sharecropper or someone who did experience abuse, but it wasn't always that. And even the way those stories were told, it's that from the dominant culture's point of view almost, and that there's no possible way there could be joy, there could be familial bonds that survived things
Right.
such as slavery and separation and things like that. There's a book that just came out last month called River Sing Me Home by Eleanor Shearer, which is about slavery within the British Caribbean and how and when that ended and what it was like. We don't necessarily hear the stories until recently about as soon as slavery ended, people were looking for their loved ones, their separated loved ones for years. I think you can even find ads in the newspapers in the like 1920s where people were still looking, I'm gonna start crying, still looking for their family members, by any means necessary up until the day they died. We don't get that. I think that adds more color to the experience and the horrors of slavery, but also it shows the resilience of a people. It wasn't step and fetch it. We
Right.
weren't just sitting there smiling and grinning. There is a reason. It's because I need to live to see another day, because maybe I'll be free tomorrow and I can go find mama or I can go find my baby sister or whoever. It's like when you see those shirts people have or things, I'm not my granny's whatever, or I'm
Right.
different. I'm not like the black people in the past. You have no idea what what that means, and it's a
Right.
total disrespect.
It's funny because I've seen those pop up a lot on a Facebook feed. And it's like at that, I mean, I understand what's being said, but I don't think that people understand the true impact of that statement. You're
Like we,
right, we're not, but you're but
yeah.
because those they provided the foundation for us. Yeah. So anything, any successes that we have, it's really based on someone else laying the foundation for us to be able to do the things we're able to do.
Or to
So.
talk down about people who chose to stay, if given the choice between liberating themselves or remaining in an enslaved situation, and the ones who stayed, you're going to look down on them. You don't do that, because we're only now hearing about how there were Maroons in the United States. They were runaway slave communities, and they actually, a lot of them are adjacent to the plantations, and the people who stayed were the ones giving them food and supplies and stealing, and that was their form of resistance. And maybe they chose to stay because that was the only way they thought to keep their family together for as long as they could. There were people who ran away, but only ran away to the forest, nearby, like Frederick Douglass, so they could stay near their families. It's more complex than that. There were black people in slavery who were runaways that would hold up guns to the slave catchers and said, "Go away and never come back." We don't hear,
Yes.
so to talk about people saying these, I'm not like my ancestors, it tells me you don't know what you're talking about. You haven't read a lot. And I'm not, it's hard, I have to check myself, like, don't come down hard on them, because we're being fed a certain story. And
Right.
it's not the truth. And so that's why we're writing these books, to kind of fill out what the truth actually was.
And that's absolutely essential, despite the fact that certain states would like to hide the truth. So, historical fiction novels featuring black, featuring female friendships are rare. What advice would you give an aspiring black female novelist?
Don't give up. If you're willing to do the work, do it. Especially reading the history is hard sometimes. While I was working on Sisters in Arms, and I was working on the part where they were in France, I wanted to get a sense of what the city of Rouen was like, because it was a city I'd never even heard of up until 6/8, and what it was like on the ground. And so I just started reading general things about France under occupation. Come to realize there were like a lot of people died from bombings during the Nazi occupation, and those bombs were dropped by allies. And as Americans, we're being fed, oh, when the allies came and landed at the beaches and liberated France, everyone was like, yay, you saved us and all that. And that's true, but afterwards there was resentment because it's like the Nazis did not kill my family, you did, because you dropped the bombs in the wrong place. And so I was like, okay, I want to add some, I never, I didn't realize, okay, there's another what that other perspective was. And just I got a book on, it's called Beyond the Beaches, and it talks about what the soldiers found when they went beyond the beaches. I only got a 1.5 pages. No. The first page of the first chapter, which is like a half page, and then I got part of the next page when I flipped it over and basically closed the book and cried myself to sleep because they talked about what it was like to be a child on the ground being bombed by the Allies. And when the dust cleared, as a 3-year-old, everybody you've known is gone. Couldn't do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like
So it's like,
what the Ukrainian kids are experiencing.
what
Yes.
war, what being in a war zone is really like, and not the
Right.
romanticized thing. So reading things like that, reading about what it was like to be an enslaved person now freed, and maybe you were born in Virginia, but now you're in Arkansas, and everything you know is just stripped away. And how do I even go about finding my mama? Or we have like over here where I am on the coast of Georgia, on St. Simon Island, where you had Muslims, literate Muslims, who were enslaved and brought over, and then basically spent the rest of their lives to come back home. And en route, when he was finally able to go back to Africa, en route on the boat died. Things like that. So it's like,
Okay, sorry.
and unfiltered. And so if you're reading historical fiction a lot, sometimes we do some sanitizing and cleaning it up. I tried not to shy away from that in the hard parts of the book, if you will, but I also didn't want to go for the low-hanging fruit. And I also wanted to be conscious of the fact that somebody's relative may read this, and I don't want to sensationalize what happened to their loved one or their relative for the sake of, oh, but it makes better drama. But how can we, make it more meaningful if somebody did experience something horrific? So it's a lot of things. And also just being respectful, because there's a lot of stories that I would love to write from the from Black female history, but is that respectful? I would love to do Eartha Kitt allegedly had an afternoon with James Dean and Paul Newman, and I would love to write that book, but it's like, am I just gonna make it sleazy? How do I make it meaningful? I think I have a way to do it, but I also, their spouses are still alive in some case, and their kids are still alive, grandkids. So it's just like, how would you do that? There's, I think I found a way to do it that's actually very compelling, and it doesn't, it's there, but it's like, how did we get to that moment type of
Right.
thing? So it's just things you got to play with.
I'm going to talk about just get some reflection from you about the 6888. So, what do you think is the significance of their service to America?
I think it gives more color about what it is to serve. There are no, I think every contribution to the greater effort matters. And you'll get a lot of people, and I know you've probably heard it, oh, they just sorted the mail. Again, you have no idea what you're talking
No.
about. Anybody who's even been to summer sleepaway camp, or if you've been in the military, you know that, and especially if you've been in a combat zone in the military, you know that piece of mail, could mean the difference in everything. And it also, even take it back to the Montgomery bus boycott. No disrespect to Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, obviously very important, but they could not be the icons they are now without those maids, without those laborers, without every single, almost every single Black person in that community committing to not getting on those buses and walking through rain, through snow, through sleet, through everything. And so all you can say, oh, all you did was just walk to work. No. If you understand, I haven't been to Montgomery myself either, but just the layout of where some of these people lived and where they had to be first thing in the morning, and the fact that they walked it or that they figured it out, okay. All right. So you just didn't ride the bus for a year. No. There's more to it than that. So I think I answered your question. I answered
Right.
your question.
Well, you
Okay.
mentioned Montgomery. My sister just went flew down there and interviewed or met Romay Davis, the oldest living 6888.
Oh,
Told
cool.
you.
Yes.
I'm hoping to get my sister. She recorded it, I said, because I want to get someone on the podcast. So I'm going to probably do a future episode with some excerpts of that
I want to
conversation.
go to Montgomery.
Oh, she said.
Fascinating history down there. And I'm sorry to cut you off. Just even, yes, I've been reading up on the boycott, but again, going back to what was going on in Montgomery for years and decades before 1955 to make 1955 to 56 happen is very fascinating. And again, it's one of those things, it wasn't just made, you were just a maid or you were just a seamstress. It's like, nope, there's way more to it than that.
Well, yeah, as you start to talk to the women, hear this, or talk to the descendants and hear their stories, people have many different roles that they played. Even though they're in the 6 AAA, not everybody actually spent most of the time handling mail. So,
Yeah. And even if they were just a part of the entertainment troupe, that was still important.
right.
So
What do you think is the legacy of the 6 AAA?
I think there is more to you than you know. There is more to your history than you know. When we look at Charity Adams, who's like the most prominent person to come out of it, she was a school teacher who wound up standing up to a general
Right.
at 20, a 26-year-old black woman in the 1940s in the United States during war. She basically committed an act, had it gone to trial, she could have been charged with treason and mutiny and even faced a firing squad. Anything, and she didn't. And anything is possible. And there's more to you than you know. I wish I had known this story when I first entered the workplace and when people tried me. And you're just like, is this what I think it is? And you think you don't have the right because you're too young or you're too whatever to say something. I wish I had known that. I might not have done what Charity Adams did, but it's like, okay, I can be more creative with this. Or even the fact that she assembled her war council, she got her girls with her, and we're gonna stay up all night. And we're gonna figure this out. We're not gonna let you fall. And that's something that you see repeatedly, not just in Sisters in Arms, but if you go and you watch the documentary 6 AAA, if you read the books that are out there, it's like time and time again, they squatted up. We're gonna figure this out. You're not alone. And that's one of the things that I wanted to highlight in my book, the fact that I don't like you and you don't like me, but oh wait, they're trying us today.
Right.
Let's huddle up and let's get this done and we can go back to hating each other tomorrow. So
Yeah,
anything is possible.
more people need to remember that. Not just more things are possible, but the need that you can work with someone you don't like for a greater cause.
Or if you are able to stand up for yourself, that person, that big, bad, ugly bulldog, you might, it's not necessarily your goal, I'm going to change his mind, but you may get their respect.
Right.
And that's after that happened, he was their biggest ally. What do you need? What do you want? He actually came back and apologized. A general apologized to a black female major in the middle of a war and was like, okay, you got the best of me and I respect
So it's a significant honor that the 6 AAA received the Congressional Gold Medal, which was a year after you published Sisters in Arms. What was your reaction when you found out the battalion received the gold medal?
I actually put in my author's note in my acknowledgments at the end. I gave a shout out to Colonel Cummings, and I said, I hope by the time this book sees print
Right.
that it's already done, but it still took another year. So I'd been very much aware of it. And as I saw things on Twitter retweeting it, I'm not going to say I played a major part like other people did. Again, everything helps. And I hope my retweets or just talking about it in my interviews, if that got one person in Congress to say, okay, yes, I'll say yes to this. Then I did my job.
So now you know we are planning a legacy return tour to Europe this summer. Go back to the
Yes.
places where in my case, my mother, but other cases, grandmothers and aunts served, and oh, they not only served, but where they were when they docked in Scotland and then served in England and France. And so you plan to join the tour.
Yes, I will be there. I'm so excited.
And what do you hope to learn about the 6 AAA by joining the tour?
Well, part of me, ego purposes, did I get it right? I've never been to any of these places. And I wrote about them. Did I get the descriptions right? Did I, I want to see that courtyard in the boys' school where they had to take showers, cold showers in the middle of
Okay,
February, things like that.
it's St. Edward's School, I think.
Yeah, at
Yeah,
King Edward School.
King, sorry, yeah.
I want to be able to.
I know kings think they're saints, but that was a slip of the tongue. Yes, King Edward.
Or even and I'm gonna get the name wrong, where they were bunked in Rouen, which was actually where Napoleon's troops were housed. You know, just to like, what would, you know, is it, you know, what was it like to go up in there and, you know, handed a sack and here, stuff straw on your own mattress, you know, things like that. What details do I wish I could have put in? Am I gonna do, I mean, people keep asking me for a sequel. How can I make, you know, add more to what I already know or was able to describe in the first book? So for me, it's just personal. And, you know, that's my selfish reasons for going, but also just there's something about walking where our foremothers walked, you know, breathing that same air, even if it's 75 years after the fact, touching that dirt. I have a bag of dirt from to Harriet Tubman's house in New York and from her grave. And when I finally get to Maryland, to her homestead there, I'm gonna add that to the dirt, and I'll probably do the same thing there. Just and I wish I'd thought to do it when I went to Iowa, to Des Moines, but basically just everywhere that they step to get some of that dirt and have it all collected in a bag, and I'll do something more formal or pretty with it when I get a chance.
Okay, that's an interesting thought, actually.
And pay my respects to our sisters in Normandy.
Absolutely, and which is certainly part of the plan for the tour as well. I'm sure that members of the audience will be interested in knowing what you're working on next, your next project. You want to tell us a little bit about that? I understand it may have some elements of maybe kind of a follow-up to Sisters in Arms.
I think you will see some familiar faces in the book earlier. My next book is tentatively called In a League of Her Own, and it is about the Effa Manley. It's a fictionalized version of Effa Manley's life, and her claim to fame is that she co-owned the Negro Leagues team, the Newark Eagles. She is currently the only woman who's been inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. She was inducted after the fact, but growing up, I was a huge baseball fan. I grew up in New Jersey. I had no idea we had a Negro Leagues team. I'm pretty, one of the stars of the Newark Eagles, Monty Irvin, his house, there's a park named after him in New Jersey that's across the street from Aunt Carmen's house. You know, so there's like links, and I'm pretty sure she knew him. But I, you know, everybody's gone now, so I can't go back and ask the questions. And it's just like, oh my God. But Effa in herself, no one knows if she was a white woman who chose to live black in the early 20th century, if she was mixed race and just light enough and she passed when she wanted to. She never correct, if you assumed wrong and she let you check into the hotel, she wasn't going to correct you. But she was pro blackity, black. She helped to integrate the workforce on 125th Street in Harlem. She hosted anti-lynching days at the ballpark. She did fundraisers for the NAACP. She told off, if you know anything about the Negro League owners in the 30s and 40s, they most of them had illegal, got their money illegally. She told them off when they needed to be told. She told off the big wigs and white baseball when they needed to be told. She told off Jackie Robinson. And she was the first Negro Leagues owner to be compensated for her players when a major league team poached, or you know, basically offered them a contract to play in the majors. So she's a big deal. And again, we don't know about her. You know, when we think of current days of women in sports and management, and we still don't really have women in the general manager's office, you know, we did. Her name was Effa Manley, and she was basically the general manager of the Newark Eagles in the 30s and the 40s. She was negotiating contracts. She was basically running the teams. She did all of the head office stuff, and her husband did all of the scouting and going on the road things. So, again, when we talk about what's our image of women of color in the 30s and 40s in the United States, it's not running baseball teams. It's not telling off gangsters and white businessmen in baseball and things like that.
All right,
So
well, will
I'm
this
having
be
fun with that one.
a historical fiction, or will
Yes.
you? Okay, all right.
Yeah. There's a number of books out about nonfiction or biographies about Effa Manley, including one that she wrote herself. But this one's
Okay.
going to be fictionalized and talk about some other things that those books don't really focus on.
This is a contemporary comment, but the one of the owners, co-owners of the Milwaukee Bucks, is a black woman.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
Yes.
So we are making strides. It's
Yeah.
getting, yeah, we're starting to see it now, but we don't, you know, it's not part of our national conversation of, you know, actually it happened back then. And I find it interesting that these, you know, it We had four black female owners in the Negro Leagues. It was in the Negro Leagues that these opportunities existed. It wasn't in white baseball or in white majority sports. In most cases, they either inherited the teams when their husbands died, or in Effa's case, her husband bought the team and they ran it together. But, they were running their teams and handling business. Actually, one of those women is still alive. She actually played in the Negro Leagues as well as owned a team in the 50s.
So she played with the guys. Okay.
There's about four or five black women that played in the Negro Leagues.
Okay.
And the only one still living is was also co-owner, or no, she owned the Detroit Stars. She got it from her uncle.
Well, I can't wait for your next novel.
I can't wait to see it either. Hopefully, it's right now it's tentatively scheduled for next spring, in spring of 2024.
So there'll probably be doses of some things that you pick up on the tour that you'll be adding in. Probably, yeah.
Hopefully, yeah.
I encourage my audience to pick up a copy of your book, Sisters in Arms, a novel of daring Black women who served during World War II. And it's available on Amazon and at your local bookstore. And
Everywhere.
it's available everywhere. Yes. And you can get it in paperback, hardback, hardcover, Kindle, and Audible.
Yes.
So did I
Can
miss
even get
any?
it in the UK.
Okay.
And that's what another thing to be excited about when we go over there. There are currently no autographed copies of the UK version. So that'll be a treat to see it in the stores there, as well as if you happen to have one of those, that's pretty rare.
How is the UK version different from the US version?
The cover.
Okay.
That's the only difference is the cover.
So I have to make sure I pick up one so I can and get it autographed like my US version. So do you have any final thoughts about the 6888, their legacy, or just anything about the 6888?
I hope now that we're realizing that there's more to these moments in American history than what we first realized, we go forward in other historical moments after them. And while we still have a bunch of those veterans and those participants still alive, we give them their flowers and their respect and we're due. We still have women who served in the Women's Army Corps in Vietnam, in Korea, all the way up until it was integrated into the re regular army in the late 70s, early 60s. Still walking among us, when we both know very well. I want to hear their stories. I want to hear their stories from them. I want to see them getting their gold medals and their flowers and their contributions recognized, because what they do isn't easy, and it isn't easy to be a woman pioneering in the military. I'm sure they've gone through some things. I'm sure people are still dealing with the effects of the things that they had to live through and maybe didn't necessarily have to. So I want all of them to get their flowers. Civil rights people who did whose names weren't in the papers every day.
And there were so many women who really were at the core of that, not just Rosa Parks, but who worked very closely with Martin Luther King, with all the other civil rights leaders who don't really get much any press
Yes.
or acknowledgement.
Yes. And even they've written their own books, and it's just not common knowledge. The women behind the movement, this is what really happened. This is how Martin Luther King became the head of we chose him to be the front man for this reason, blah, 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 blah. So there's a lot going on there. The Freedom Riders, I'm sure. I haven't d dug too deep in that, but there's so much, and they're still with us. And that's, I think it's great that they got their gold medal. I wish it had happened at least 20 years ago,
Right.
when there were more of us. Even with the major leagues recognizing the stats of the Negro League players, when they finally made that resolution, there were only four players alive that would benefit from it, and one of them died the next day.
Another group that I had not heard of before is the Montrepoint Marines. And there apparently were about 10,000 of them. And there's still
They're still running.
a group that's dedicated to finding them and getting them their gold medals. I went to a ceremony in Philadelphia. A month or so ago, where they were giving the gold medals to some of the descendants. So, and they got their gold medal in 2012.
But that was like the foundation that they were able to build on upon to get the 6888 their gold medal. So I just don't think we should not wait until there's only four or six people alive from a group of almost 1,000.
Right.
We can do better than that.
Well, yes, if we don't keep repeating the same historical errors and mistakes, but we're in very challenging times as far as that's concerned.
Yes.
But I thank you for what you do and what your
Thank
novel
you.
has brought to the world. Because sometimes people have a lot of trouble kind of just reading a straight history book. And so the color that historical fiction, your novel in particular, brings to the story. And being familiar with the story, I could see it sometimes. And sometimes when I'm thinking about it, it's like your story is so close to fact, but more colorful, that it's like, wait a minute, did I read that? Did I see that in Taye's book, or was that something I read in Brenda Moore's book, or in, so it's like, yeah, or is it something related to something I saw in my mother's collection?
Yeah, but I'll be quick to tell you, oh, I made that up. Or that didn't happen like that. This is what really happened. So, but I did, part of me, you know, a lot of historical fictions, the debate is how true to life should you be?
Where's that
And
line?
some people are just like, make it up. And I was on that, you know, I was okay with that until I realized before I went to fact check myself, I had, you know, the story set in 1943. There was all this other stuff going on, and went back and realized, oh, wait, there was only just this group that went. They're the only ones. So there's no way this story, I can't just make up the fact, you know, say, oh, I'm going to put them going over in 43. It didn't happen, you know, and the fact I wanted to keep it as true to plausibility as possible, because I know this is the first time a lot of people are being introduced to their story. And sometimes people run away with things you read in fiction as fact. Like if you watch a
Right.
historical biopic, you know, when I went to, I didn't go to, I forget the name of the place now, but up in New York where they shipped out of Camp Shanks. I
Right.
didn't go to Camp Shanks, but I went to the historical society that was in the area. And, you know, I mentioned, oh, I can't exactly prove this line in the newspapers we were going through, so I was like, I can fudge it, I can and fudge it responsibly. And she got mad at me because she had just dealt with all these people coming through with that TV show called Turn about Washington spies during the Revolutionary War, and they made up so much and they fictionalized so much that just wasn't true or even possibly true. And it all took place in that same area when Benedict Arnold was found in the woods and realized that he was the traitor. And so she has to deal with civilians or regular people coming in and arguing with her about what they saw on TV was fact, and she's like, that didn't happen at all. And I'm an expert, and it ha you know this the event happened down the street. You know, there's just no, you know, so I try not, I try to be respectful of that. Historians hate that when you're like, oh, I just made it up. You know, it's like, I made it up, but I did it based on X, Y, and Z. So hopefully that I'm being respectful to the
Right.
history.
And I thought that that was very evident in the book. So
Thank you. I'm glad.
I consider you to be successful with that. I don't know, any closing thoughts you want to add before we wrap this evening?
No, I just want to thank you for reaching out, for inviting me. I can't wait to hang out with you in Europe and hear more of your stories as well as other family members' stories, one-on-one, what happened to their particular family member. I got a sense of that when we all met in DC last year, and I just, you know, have more meaningful conversations because it was just one day and now we have 2 weeks.
It's going to be great with a small group going where we can really get to know each other. And I'm trying to work on a way to document it from a film standpoint. So yeah, we'll
We'll
see
see.
how that works out. So
Yeah, I might break down and buy an actual camera so it's not all stuck on my phone.
I have enough of them for everybody. So
Oh, okay, cool.
I don't usually when I'm traveling, I don't usually use the cell phone on the camera. I always have cameras around my neck. So, but Kaia, thank you so much for joining us tonight and discussing your amazing novel. I am very grateful.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, and I almost forgot my soapbox. If your people, the older people in your family are still alive, talk to them and find out their stories. And if they're not, then it's your job to tell your stories to the people in your family who come behind you, even if you don't think it's interesting because it seems mundane. It's fascinating to them, and you never know what you've done is going to blow their minds. You know, we've lived through historical moment. We lived through things like January 6th, we've lived through September 11th. I wasn't there at the Olympic bombing in Atlanta, but my friends were the people you saw laid out in the street
Right.
the next day. So we've all had things where you're just like, oh yeah, I guess I was there. That is actually fascinating, and it means something to your family. Nobody in my family made the connection about my great uncle He just happened to mention I'm not a World War II vet because I enlisted in July 45. I'm a Korea vet. And I was the one who said, oh, so you were there before, during, and after desegregation of the military. And all of his kids were like, what? And he's like, oh, yeah, that.
Yeah, my father
So,
was a Korean vet, and I have letters that he wrote to the army. He was stationed at Camp Hope, Louisiana, and he wrote a letter in February of 1952, describing the housing conditions. And he's talking about having a wife, a pregnant wife, and a 1-year-old. I'm the one. I was the 1-year-old. I didn't even know, I never knew I lived in Louisiana until this fall, past fall. But he's writing this as he was a physician and a captain, and he's writing and said there are no housing, suitable housing accommodations for Negro officers and their families. And he described the conditions, even 50 miles away. So he asked, he sent the family back to D.C., and he asked to be transferred from Louisiana closer to D.C. so that he could be near his family. He wrote that letter in February. My baby sister was born in February and died April, early April, and they transferred him 2 weeks after her death. So every time I read that, in my father's own words, it was typed on an old Royal typewriter, it brings me to tears. And so it's important to know these stories. I mean, we recently, again, when doing our historical research, we discovered that my great grandfather in 1810 was reading and writing. And people think in Georgia it was illegal to teach black folks to read and write back in 18 in that period. So it's kind of fascinating. So my daughter said to me, she said, "Mom, now that you've done this research, what are you going to do with all this?" I said, "I don't know. Right now, I'm collecting it because I can connect dots that the next generation is too young to connect. We can think, when I talk to my siblings, we can say, okay, yeah, grandma said this or dad said that or grandpa said that." And we can pull those pieces together. And so I just haven't figured out how to pull them together yet, but at least we're collecting them. So it is so important for people not to just live in the moment and think of just what you can access through Google. Google is not history.
It's the
And
beginning. It's not the end.
each person, the thing that I don't think people understand is that everybody has a story. Everybody has a unique story and an important story to be documented.
And even if it's shameful, you find it to be shameful, you have to remember that those people, had those people not survived, that you would not be here. And so there's value in that too. And also, you can only judge them so much. People had to do what they had to do. I heard
Right.
one historian like talk about when you lived in occupied, Nazi occupied Europe, you had to make decisions that you never thought you would do, that us looking back on, like, how could you do that? Every day was like, how you had to make a decision whether I live or die, or if I do something, my whole town could be murdered because of
Right.
something I did. And so you can't, you have to show that respect. In the process of writing this book, I knew my grandfather had been one of the first black firefighters in New York. I had no idea he was the president of the fraternal society in New York during the war, or that
Okay.
he led a cont you know that he oversaw a compilation of a report of how they were being treated unfairly, and they were presenting it to city council and to Mayor LaGuardia and things like that. His brother, the Korea vet, was still alive when I figured out. He's like, I didn't know about that. I knew, he didn't talk about it. And even my dad was like, oh, and when I would find certain things, he's like, oh, wait, I know that. And he would start telling these stories. I'm like, dude, really? So, you just never, again, people do amazing things every day. And it might, it may not make the paper, but that one little nugget of thing that they did, a kindness that they showed somebody, helped, Martin Luther King, Georgia Gilmore, she was a sweet potato pie lady in Montgomery. And he just, Martin Luther King just happened to tell her after she lost her job, why don't you just start serving plates out of your house? And she was able to help fund the boycott with her pies and support herself because of that one little suggestion that this big person said. And it made all the difference in helping Martin Luther King become the Martin Luther King we all revere today.
It's a good message to end on. Again, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us this evening.
It's my
And
pleasure.
I'm looking forward to seeing you in Europe.
Okay, I'll see you in
All
Europe,
right.
somewhere in Europe.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Nexus 818 podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like us to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I'd like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I'll share two quotes. The first is an African proverb. If we stand tall, it is because we stand on the shoulders of many ancestors. The second reflection is from Dr. Mae Jemison, the first African-American female astronaut. Never be limited by other people's limited imagination. To these quotes, I add that we stand on the shoulders of the 6888 Battalion who courageously dared and achieved. See you for our next show on Wednesday, April 5th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Google Podcasts, and Spotify.